Okay, talk.
Okay, testing 1, 2, 3. Hello, hello. You can hear me fine now. Good volume.
Yeah, I can hear you, and it doesn't make my head want to explode.
Okay. Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Saturday, June 8th, 2019. It's just before 23 UTC as we're recording this. This is really, really late, and sorry about that. This is Sam Minter, and Ivanbo is not here this week. Ivan was in Argentina and blah, blah, blah. I did my usual call for co-hosts, and Brandy, my wife, agreed to join us this week. So hello, Brandy.
Hello, Sam. How are you today?
Stressed. And so then we were going to do this Friday night, but things got in the way, and that might be one of the topics later in terms of what exactly got in the way. Then I was going to do it Saturday morning, but I had to get a blog post for election graphs out. That took way longer than I wanted to, and I got up late, and blah, 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 and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. So sometimes I post these a little bit late, but I always, always, always record these at the very latest by Saturday. So getting this out now. And so this, we'll see how long this is, but because both of us have other things we need to be doing. Anyway, we will follow the same format that we've followed for the last few weeks, which is two topics per segment, alternating who is picking the segments. Brandy will pick a topic, then I will pick a topic, and then we will decide whether or not we're going on to another round. And we'll take a break and come back for another round if indeed we are continuing. And that will be the pattern. I'm not sure how many rounds we'll do this time. It depends what the topics are, how long they take, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, Brandy, as the guest, you have the first topic choice. What do you want to talk about first?
We could talk about how you poisoned my dog.
Yes. So those of you who have been listening for a while know that we had an incident a couple months back where both of our dogs got a hold of some kind of treat that had raisins in it that they were not supposed to get. What was it?
An English muffin.
It was an English muffin, a raisin English muffin. And we had to take them to the vet and get very, very expensive treatment on both of them because grapes and raisins are highly toxic to dogs. And so I knew about this. And even before that, it had happened to one of our dogs years ago as well. So this is something I very much knew and was aware of. So on Friday evening, I was picking our dog up from the place where he goes for like daycare during the day so he can exercise with other dogs and stuff like that that we can't provide at home. And I had a leftover. So I'd gotten one of these protein packs from Starbucks. It has apples and grapes, but I'd eaten all the grapes, so they were gone. Some cheese, what else does it have? Eggs. It has eggs, and it has this little thing of bread and a packet of peanut butter. You put the peanut butter on the bread, and then you eat it. I'm trying to be good about carbs, and so lately, when I've had this, I've eaten everything except the little thing of bread. Which I'd left there. So this was left in my car. And when I brought the dog back to my car from the daycare, he started sniffing it. I'm like, ooh, do you want that? And like, I actually handed the thing to him. And then as I am handing it to the dog and the dog is reaching for it, sparks go off into my brain, alarm bells. Wait a second, that's not plain bread. What the hell is that bread? I have no idea what that bread is. So I rip it away from the dog, but by that time he'd already got a bite in his mouth. I look around to try to reach to see if I can like grab it out of his mouth, but I'm in the front seat. He's in the back seat. I can't reach him. I can't get to his mouth. And by that time he's swallowed. So I'm like, oh, what is in this bread? I look at it and there are little flakes of something or other. And I'm like, oh man, those look like they might be raisins. And so I read the ingredients on the thing, and sure enough, it's raisins. And so I call Brandy, I get her voicemail. I call her again, I get her voicemail. I start just rushing to, I'm like, okay, I just have to go straight to the vet. I know the deal with this, I have to go straight to the vet. So I start going to the emergency 24-hour vet that's still in my freaking GPS from last time this happened as a recently used address. And yeah, so that's how it started. I guess to skip to the end of the story, I think he's going to be fine. They pumped, no, they didn't pump his stomach. They induced vomiting and gave him activated charcoal. And that's it. What else do you want to say about it, Brandy?
You poisoned my dog. I'm sorry. Was there more I should be saying? One thing I do have to say is this totally clears me from closing my trunk on your head last weekend.
Yes. Even though I can still feel that.
Yeah. Well, you poisoned my dog.
Yes. Well, the other thing, and you know, we did talk about this quite a bit when the last time this happened, it's really frustrating how little they know about this kind of poisoning. They know it can kill dogs, but only some dogs, only some of the time, and they don't understand why, and they don't know the mechanism, and they don't know exactly what the thing is in the grapes and raisins that are actually poisonous. So, and they just basically know nothing other than, okay, we have to treat it as if this was a significant poison. But one thing that got me, so I should add a couple more steps. While I was on the way to the vet, Brandy was calling animal poison control. And they told her basically, oh, since he's been through something like this before and ended up fine, you can probably just induce vomiting at home and keep him home and probably everything will be fine.
I think what we need to add to this is that they told me to call when I was calling the vet because mm-hmm. I told them what had happened. And they said, okay, so first you're going to call this number. And they gave me an 800 number and they're like, it's $59. And they're going to, you know, talk to them and they'll tell you what you need. And then they can, you know, work with us if they need to. And I'm like, okay, that's weird that they're telling me to call somewhere else to give them $50, but okay, sure. So after we go through all of the stuff at the vet, and after, you know, Sam had given them the number for the case number for jet ski, they were like, oh, you called emergency management? We didn't know that, even though we'd given them the case number. And then they got really anxious and wanted to know who exactly told me to call.
Yeah.
Because they were like, wait, they had you call this number? And wait, what? Who did you call? And I'm like, I called you guys. I'm like, I'm looking at it, my phone. There they are. There's the 800 number. And there they are again. Like, I didn't even dial them the second time. I just clicked my previous call. So they were really unhappy about that. And the poison people said something kind of different than what the vet said, I suspect mm-hmm. that's part of why. Mm. But it was still kind of crazy.
Well, and the other thing is, and we had to make a decision about whether to keep the dog at the hospital for 48 hours for them to observe and give more fluids and stuff, or just let them do the initial treatment and then take him home and bring him back in a couple of days for blood tests. And we went back and forth and agonized over this decision and blah, blah, blah. But you know, the poison control center had said, hey, he'll probably just be fine. You just make him throw up at home and you'll be good. My sister, who is also a veterinarian, also sort of seemed to think that he'd probably be fine as long as we had gotten him to throw up fast enough, which we were at the vet and he was getting his vomiting induced like within half an hour. And but then they had to tell us all the worst case scenarios of exactly what would happen. And look, I recognize they have to do that. They can't like say, oh, everything will be fine. You go home, your dog dies. And then you were like, but you told me everything would be fine. So they have to tell you the worst case scenario and make sure you understand it. And it's part of your decision-making process and all that. But you know, we had to decide, you know, are we going to do this or not? And I ended up deciding to bring him home because of what the Poison Control Center had said, because of what my sister had said. And you know, we'd spent a lot of money on this last time around, and it wasn't the money. The money wasn't the bottom line. We could have afforded it. We could have done it if we needed to, but it's sort of like, yeah, it just seemed like a lot. And everyone seemed to say, you know, he's probably going to just be fine. He'd probably be fine even without any treatment at all, to be honest. But you know, there is a risk. And, so we did it. But then in the discharge papers, they gave us to take home, there was an interesting little bit talking about, you know, toxicity had been found in cases of grapes and raisins with as little as half an ounce per pound of body mass. Now, our dog is now something like 66 pounds. So at that ratio, it would have taken about 2 pounds of grapes or raisins to be the amount that they said had been previously shown to be toxic. And he weighed nowhere near that much. He ate like one bite of a stupid little, whatever they call those round bready things from Starbucks. And so that was another factor. And then, you know, when we were coming out, the nurse, who turns out has one of Jetski's litter mates, is now, as she adopted the litter mate, was like, yeah, I would take him to home too if I were you. We just have to make sure you understand everything and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so that last thing about the dosages makes me really wonder, like, you know, I understand they have to have the standard advice of, you know, we don't understand this thing. We don't understand exactly why dogs die from this and why they don't. And so our advice is going to be very, very aggressive about it. But it really seems like maybe that's a bit excessive for the actual, I don't know. I understand where that comes from, but if that dosage thing is correct and the actual observed negative effect toxicity has never been observed with less than that ratio, then they could have just said, you know, look, that amount is probably fine. You know, we've never seen a case where a dog has gotten seriously ill from that amount. So, you know, don't worry about it. And I guess I understand why they don't do that, but still, it seems like, unless some of the information we got was wrong. I don't know. What do you think, Brandy?
I was seriously starting to wonder if the vet got paid with commissions, because she really wanted us to leave him there. Or maybe she just wanted to play with him. Who knows?
Well, no, she actually did make clear on a couple times. She's like, look, both decisions would probably be fine.
Yeah.
You know, and she mentioned that when talking to Poison Control, they'd actually also told her an additional thing, which she had not heard before, and I had not heard before either in our previous instance with this, is that when the raisins are in baked goods, the risk is actually even less.
Which is awesome.
Yeah. But anyway, we took the dog home. So far, he's absolutely fine. Of course, the other thing they had to tell us is, look, if you take him home and something goes wrong, by the time he's got noticeable symptoms, it's probably very, very serious, and there might not be much we could do.
No worries.
No worries. Yeah, thank you for that. He's acting absolutely fine so far, but yeah, I don't know. And my sister's like, look, you know, you could take him in for additional blood work at 24 hours and 48 hours and 72 hours instead of just at 48 hours. But honestly, they'll probably all be fine.
And what they said when I asked, you know, what's the difference? Why is it more important for him to, you know, stay here? And they're like, well, we monitor him, but they only test him every 24 hours. So it's like, okay, but why do you need him to be here then? And it's because they want to be able to pump him full of fluids too.
Yes.
So,
and keep him with IV fluids rather than, what they were able to do when he goes home is they give subcutaneous fluids, which, you know, is a little bit different anyway.
And really weird. Cause you end up with these jiggly little sacks of goo.
Yeah. I honestly couldn't really notice it on Jetski way back when I was a teenager. We had cats and occasionally they had that, and it was really obvious in the cats when we got that, but I don't know.
Put them between the shoulders, right?
Probably. I don't know. Yeah, that sounds right.
Okay, I Googled it.
Yes. And?
Subcutaneous fluids. I'm not sure. Okay, this is definitely on animals. This is on cats. But when they put it in, I think they put it in the back, right?
I don't know. I would imagine that there are some standard places, but that depending on what's going on, they may shift it some. But I don't know. Why are you asking me? I'm not the veterinarian.
And then it starts to shift.
Right. And it can move
on
around.
On a cat from where it is and ends up down in their belly or, you know, in their legs. So it's a place where you don't notice it. So I suspect, yeah.
Okay. Anything else about me poisoning your dog?
Don't do it again.
I will try not. I had no idea those things had raisins in them.
You made all the rules. You were like, we can't have anything that has raisins in the house.
I didn't know that thing had raisins.
I love cinnamon raisin things, but you know, I don't have them in the house because you're so adamant about them.
Well, this wasn't even in the house. It was in my car, but I had no idea those things had raisins.
Mm-hmm.
If I had, I probably still would have had the thing. I mean, it has grapes in it too, but I ate the grapes. But if I had, I would have made sure I'd thrown away those before I let the dog in, let alone offer the stupid dog the thing. But I had no idea they had raisins in them. And you're like, when I mentioned that, you like were looking at me like, what do you mean you had no idea they had raisins in them? Can't you taste them? I don't know.
Can't you see them?
No. No.
Okay.
I never had any idea that those things had raisins in them.
There's a part of me that wonders if you, this was a subconscious way to avoid having to go pick up Jetski from daycare, but you know, hey, that's just me.
I'd already picked him up.
Yes. But do you think I'll let you pick him up now that you've poisoned him?
I took him to the vet afterwards.
Good job.
Okay.
At least.
Yeah. At least what? At least what?
At least you took him to the vet and you're going to get to submit the
insurance
thing. Paperwork for the insurance.
Yeah. That'll be exciting. Yeah. Okay. So my turn for a topic. We've talked for quite a few weeks on this show about impeachment and whether it should happen, if it should happen, what form it should take. So what I'm going to do, Brandy, as I'm going to talk about, because I know you disagree with me here. So I'm going to give hopefully a relatively concise version of my position and just let me talk through it. And then you can tell me all the reasons I'm wrong. Okay. And I will listen politely to all the reasons I'm wrong.
Yes, you will.
Until you tell me it's my turn to talk again. Okay. So my primary take on this, there are a few aspects of it. But first of all, is that the number one priority here is the Democrats have to show themselves to be properly aggressive with what they're doing here. Now, there are many forms of being aggressive other than actual impeachment hearings and actual impeachment process. But they have to be extremely aggressive and go after this in a way that looks like they want to, looks like they're vigorous about it, looks like they care about the results. I have been extremely frustrated to date since the Democrats took office in the House in January at the pace at which they are moving. They have been moving extremely slowly in my view. I was very frustrated that they were waiting. In many cases, they kept going, oh, we're waiting for the Mueller report. We're waiting for the Mueller report. Whereas from the very beginning, it was clear, A, that even in the space of the Mueller report, there were things that they could be doing independently. But also, there are all sorts of things to look at that were clearly outside the scope of what the Mueller report was looking at, of what Mueller was looking at. And so they took months to put in the first request for his taxes. All of this kind of thing. And they've, when the administration has said no, they've repeatedly been like, here's a deadline. Administration comes and doesn't meet that deadline. Well, okay, here's another deadline. Here's another deadline. And they have not been anywhere near as aggressive as they could. And I think they do need to be. I think there is sort of a moral duty to do the right thing here that is involved in going through the process. And I think there's a question of when is the right time to formally call it impeachment. I think it is necessary that at some point before we get to the election, they do a formal impeachment, because it's a statement that if they don't do that, it's sort of conceding the ground that we're okay with this behavior. And I don't think that is an acceptable message or precedent to set for the future. Forget about Donald Trump. Think about the next corrupt president that comes into office. Anything that happens here will be used as part of that argument further down the road. I think there is a moral duty for them to do what they can here. The other part of it is everybody keeps arguing that this will kill the Democrats. If they go through this process and then it gets acquitted in the Senate, which is the almost inevitable result, that would hurt the Democrats. And my reaction to that is only if the Democrats do this in the most stupid way possible. If they start an impeachment proceeding today and rush through it in a few weeks, impeach the president, send it to the Senate. The Senate, goes through a rush trial because they don't really want to do it. And they acquit him in a few weeks as well. And by this fall, we're already completed the process. There's been an impeachment. There's been an acquittal. And everybody says, oh, well, we tried. We're all done. That would be a disaster for the Democrats. Another way it would be a disaster is if they start impeachment hearings and then don't actually impeach. I've heard a number of people making the argument that, well, we're only talking about impeachment hearings. We're not talking about impeachment. I think that completely ignores the reality that if you start the process and do not finish it, that will be a political disaster. I think the way to do it properly, and maybe the Democrats just don't have this in them, but the way to do it properly is, first of all, yes, this investigative stage that we're in now has to go on a little bit longer. I am not an advocate for an impeachment right now, this very second. I think it should be, at the minimum, quite a few months away yet, in terms of switching from the independent investigations we have now in different parts of the Congress to a single impeachment investigation, let alone the actual impeachment. Each one of these stages should take a considerable portion of the time between now and the election. You know, there should be extensive and incredibly aggressive investigations in the different committees. Then finally, once all of those have sort of gotten to a point where they've each independently developed a whole bunch of information, then you can kick off an official impeachment inquiry in the House that tries to consolidate all of that information in a coherent way. And when I talk about all of the independent investigations, that's actually very key to me. Even to this day, I keep hearing people concentrating on the Mueller stuff and the Trump-Russia stuff. That is such a small sliver of what they should be looking at. There's so much corruption stuff. There's so much misuse of office stuff. There's potential violation of international laws in terms of how we're treating people on the border. There's the emolument stuff. There's all kinds of stuff to look at here. And I recognize that's a complex picture, but you have to be digging aggressively into all of it. and not focusing only on Mueller, only on obstruction of justice. The other thing that I've said quite a few times on Twitter and on our Curmudgeon's Corner Slack, but I don't think I've said on the podcast yet, is I don't think there should be one impeachment. I think there should be many. The way that impeachment has worked in the past, in the two times it has happened before, is that the House has issued a single impeachment with multiple counts of all the things they thought the president did wrong, and then that goes to the Senate. I don't think that's an appropriate way to do it in the case where you are fairly sure the Senate is going to acquit. Instead, first of all, when you do the impeachment process, you have to, from the very beginning, make clear that your expectation is the Senate is going to acquit. I see like all of these people saying that, well, maybe the Senate, given the right in evidence, maybe some senators will start coming around. But no, no. If that happens, awesome. But nobody should be planning on that. Plan on the fact that the Senate will acquit. And so what you want to do is you want to package it in individual bits where you're talking about one very, very clear piece of wrongdoing, independent of the other things that you can bring up and you can make a very succinct case on. Because one of the problems with the Donald Trump stuff is there's so much of it and it's so complicated how all the pieces fit together and people's eyes glaze over and they don't understand. You want to boil it down to here is this thing he did. So the strategy I would suggest is actually that the House issue an impeachment on one narrowly focused thing for which the evidence is very clear, send it to the Senate, then make the Senate, make all the Republican senators go on record defending this guy and voting to acquit him. There are a number of purple state senators where this will hurt them in the race for the Senate. Make them go on record for that. And then once they acquit him, repeat the whole process with the next thing and keep that going all the way through until Election Day. And the other division of labor that I think is important there is that I think the House committee who's doing this needs to be, you know, okay, those Democrats concentrate on that. Your other Democrats can worry about other things. And so people keep talking about the split brain of, oh, we have to be giving our positive message and blah, blah, blah. Not every Democrat has to do both. Pick which Democrats are doing which. The Democrats who are on the relevant committees can go after Donald Trump aggressively. The Democrats who aren't, and including most of the ones running for president, should concentrate on the other stuff and say, well, that process is going on. I agree it's the right process to do, but we'll let that play out. And I think the argument is that if you go through all this process and you get the acquittal, the Democrats, you know, the Trump folks will be like jumping up and down saying, look, they're acquitted. It was a witch hunt, blah, blah, blah. He was completely innocent, you know, et cetera. This was a huge waste of time. They're going to say that no matter what. They're already saying that. They've been saying that for 2 years already. They're going to continue to say that. They're going to say that aggressively no matter what. If you fill the space with making the case in a very public, visible way, then that counter case becomes more visible than it has been so far. You have to have coherent messaging. You have to have smart messaging to do it right. But then I don't see a way that helps Donald Trump. It doesn't necessarily hurt him because we've seen that the polls hardly ever move, no matter what happens. They bounce up and down in a very narrow range. But so it may not hurt Donald Trump, but I can't see how it helps. And I think the people who are arguing that it would help are wrong and are misreading the lessons of history on this kind of stuff. Whereas I think the opposite, if Democrats actually sort of decide, hey, we really don't want to deal with this. Let's, you know, there'll be some investigations going on, but we're not going to impeach and we're not going to concentrate it on it. And let's talk about healthcare. I think if you do that, a lot of people who are mad and upset and fired up over Donald Trump will get disillusioned and have the mindset of, why the hell did we elect these Democrats anyway? They can't do jack. they don't even have the confidence of their convictions. They have a clear thing in front of them and they're not even willing to fight for it. And I think that would actually depress turnout in a way that would hurt Democrats more. Okay, I've gone on way too long for that. Now I will shut up completely and let you go until you tell me it's my turn to talk.
First, I'd like to point out the fact that I didn't say a word.
Good job. Oh, so, yep. I'm shutting up again.
Well, it's fine. It's fine. Okay. So, the major fault in your argument is that you're looking at history to determine where things go next and how reactions will be. We are no longer playing by the same rules we were before. We have an administration that has absolutely no regard for the law or the Constitution. We've never been in a position like this before. I mean, we've had some presidents who have done some pretty crappy things, but never to this extent, never with this much disregard for what this country is founded on. And because of that, if we're sitting there trying to play by the rules and they're not playing by the rules, there's no way we can win. None. At all. See the stupid little game he just recently played with the whole tariff thing. And it turns out with Mexico, and it turns out that the agreement was actually for Mexico to strengthen their southern border. It was actually made in March. But he came up with the whole, oh, we're going to do this and we're going to be all like super mean and tight or whatever. And we're going to make them pay tariffs unless they do this. Oh, look, they're doing it. So we're going to not make them pay tariffs. See, I won. And everybody's like, yay, Trump. But he literally made it up. But it doesn't matter. Because he's got his whole little group of people who are going to follow him and think that he is wonderful and that he is creating support. Because it doesn't really matter fundamentally whether or not he is telling the truth. What matters is that people are willing to follow him. So when it comes down to the impeachment issue, we're going to see a similar result that we saw to the Mueller thing, which was basically like Trump and his people crowing, see, I'm exonerated. Because the report came in and nothing happened. Now, it doesn't matter that there wasn't really much they could do because it was about finding facts, not necessarily trying to make charges against the president. That's not within the purview of that team. But it doesn't matter because this report happened and nothing happened. So, or at least not to Trump directly, the result of which says that he's Teflon. You can't get him. He's impervious to having this shit stick to him right now. So if we go through and we do another investigation, not only are they going to do everything they can to obstruct the access to any information in order to have these investigations, which means, by the way, that they won't be completed until well after the election, assuming they can even get started. So there's none of this getting it done quickly. That's not going to happen. It's impossible. We're going to see the same amount of obstruction, if not more. They're not going to be able to get any information. The result's going to be they didn't get any information because there was no information to get. Trump wins again. He's not the only corrupt person here. And we know this. We know that it wasn't just him who was compromised in the first place. There were members of Congress, the Senate, who are similarly compromised. And so they're going to do everything within their power to ensure that he stays in power. So as long as he can prevent us from being able to conduct a reasonable investigation, he's going to maintain his power. And unless we can actually do something that has a result, like removing him from office or throwing his ass in jail, we have failed. And if we fail, then all that does is give him more strength. And I know you think that it's like, we've got to do this, we've got to do something. But the truth is, whatever we do, we're going to be making a sacrifice. Because if we try to do something and we fail, it shows that we are ineffective. It's not showing that Trump is a criminal. He's a freaking criminal. There's no doubt about it. Everybody knows it. Most people don't care. But what's going to happen is it's going to show that we are ineffective. And if we are ineffective, then we have no business being in office. And if we have no business being in office, might as well replace us with some Republicans. And people are going to get hurt. Because if even starting impeachment hearings is going to help support his reelection, that means there are people in a lot of marginalized communities who are not going to be doing very well. Because despite his whole, oh, I love black people, oh, I love the gays, all that kind of crap, none of that is true. And he's happy to throw anybody under the bus in order to maintain what he believes is, you know, his control of this country. So not only does trying to do something make us look ineffective, not only does it risk us losing the advantage we do have in the House, it also risks the livelihood and safety of millions of people. And I don't think it's worth that risk. I get the whole do something because it's the right thing to do, but that only works if everybody's playing by the same damn rules. And that's not happening now. So as long as that's not happening, we need to try something different too. And that could be as simple as setting up a strategy that will have us going through impeachment procedures after the election in the event that he's actually reelected. Because, you know, going through the hearings and stuff and not being able to do anything about it isn't going to help Democrats. You can argue that it might not help him, but it certainly won't help us. That being the case, maybe it's more strategic to wait. At least that's my thought process. Okay, you can talk now.
Okay. So I should have taken notes. I didn't. A couple of thoughts. First of all, in terms of the do something different, I think a lot of what I was suggesting before is very different in terms of of doing a sort of an impeachment multiple times, not just once, things like that. But also, a lot of what you said depends on the expectations game. And that's why I was saying it would be very, very wrong for Democrats to embark on this process building up the expectation that the result would be removing Trump. They have They have to do it in such a way where they set out from the very beginning that what they are trying to do here is expose the wrongdoing in a more highly visible way and force Republican senators onto the record on this. And you say that there's no way Democrats could benefit from this. I don't actually agree. I think forcing Republican senators in purple states to go through a trial and vote to acquit this guy will hurt those Republicans in purple states. And I think that an ongoing barrage of these processes going through this whole, you know, when you're holding public hearings and you're holding impeachment hearings, these are the kinds of things that end up on, you know, gavel to gavel coverage on all the cable networks, including Fox. And you get the kind of exposure you don't have from the report. And so I think there are marginal people who are on the edges, who will be influenced by these. But even more important, I think you'll get more of the Trump folks who are willing to sort of put up for Trump, but aren't excited about it, even less excited about it. You're never going to get the core Trumpies. But if you get some of the people who are holding their nose and voting for Trump to decide that he's just not worth it, you may not get them to vote for Biden or Harris or Warren, but you might get them to stay home, which is effectively the strategy that Trump ran last time before, which is forget about the people in the middle. I don't care about them. I'm going to hype up my bass to the maximum degree possible. And he won that way. And just barely by the skin of his teeth, I should say. But he won that way. And I think the Democrats are better off going with that kind of base-centric strategy, which, by the way, exciting the base includes being incredibly aggressive going after Trump. And I think that there are a number of people who you say, yeah, I don't want to risk doing this. I think that underplays the risk of not doing it, because not doing it also makes you look ineffective. I mean, you're arguing, well, if you don't get anything, if trying something doesn't have the result, you're better off not trying at all. But the decision not to try at all already shows that weakness and ineffectiveness and whatever. That's baked into the cake. Like the structure of our government right now is that Democrats do not have the power to remove Donald Trump. Period. It's not going to happen. You'd have to have, they don't have 2/3 of the Senate. So that's not going to happen unless something absolutely miraculous happens that actually does flip Republicans, but nobody should count on that. So you have to do it in such a way where you're maximizing how much fight it looks like you have, frankly, because if you go in there and you're super aggressive and you do everything you can, and I include things like you mentioned, they don't follow the rules. And so they're fighting everything. They're resisting these subpoenas, blah, blah, blah. And the court battles are going to take months and months and months. Another thing that Congress should be looking at is they should seriously be looking at inherent contempt and like throwing some of these people in jail, like on their own authority without any courts that the Supreme Court has upheld in the past that they have the right to do that. So they should be looking at, you know, Barr and Mnuchin and some of these other people for contempt of Congress. And, you know, yes, actually sending out the Capitol Police to arrest them and bring them back and hold them in confinement until they do what they're supposed to do and either testify or produce documents or whatever it is. They have to use every ounce of their power that they have. And that will gain respect for, oh, man, they're fighting, even if they lose in the end. If they go down fighting and showing that they've given it absolutely everything they've got, that will earn a lot of respect. Whereas if they sort of, what they look like right now is they look like people who are afraid of the fight and who are reluctant to use the power that they have. And so they're constantly pulling their punches. They're constantly negotiating when they could be making demands. They're constantly giving in, like the thing that's driven me crazy the most so far is the deadlines that like some of these congressional committees have put on time after time after time and said, you have until this time to give us the documents. And then they don't give them. And then they give them a new deadline. And then they don't give them. And then they give them a new deadline. And it takes them 3 or 4 iterations of that before they're like, oh, okay. And then on other occasions where they've demanded certain things and the administration has said, we're not going to give you that. But we're willing to negotiate. And then they end up going in and negotiating and they get something, but not everything. And then they're like, oh, okay, that's good. As an example of that was the subpoena of Don Jr., which the Republicans were in on that subpoena, by the way, that was in the Senate, which was surprising, but you know, they ended up saying, oh, okay, fine. We'll agree to your conditions. The Democrats have done similar things on the House side. And I think that impression leaves people thinking these Democrats are useless. They don't even try. And I fundamentally think that just from a pure political perspective, leave aside the issues of doing the right thing and setting a precedent for future administrations, which I actually think is very important, because if you don't do anything here, then the next Donald Trump 20 years from now will have an even easier way to do it. But even putting that aside and just talking politics, I actually think it's better politics to go after this aggressively than it is to sort of try to put it aside and concentrate on other things. Now, and I've heard some people in the House say, look, the argument within the Democrats isn't actually impeach or don't impeach. It's just when to impeach. And on that side, I'm definitely, I'm fine with some delay as long as the existing committees are being aggressive. In fact, I think some delay would be smart. like I said, I think given that you know there's not going to be an acquittal, I mean, given that you know there is going to be an acquittal, there's not going to be a removal, I think the Democrats should be like making sure this is a constant background drone from now till election day and not let up at one moment. And I think they should have their foot on the gas the entire time. And that probably means spending the next 6 months doing non-impeachment hearings, but then sometime in the fall or winter or early spring next year, switching it to impeachment. Now, what I've heard a number of folks say is like, hey, if you're going to do this, you have to do it now because nobody's going to want to think about it in 2020. I think that would be completely wrong because anything they could do rushing it like that would definitely not be effective and would be bad. If you're going to do it, you have to do it in such a way that it completely sucks the air out of the room between now and election day.
I would be totally down with non-impeachment background hearings. That would make sense. But
well, and I think that there's one thing that they could do right now that they haven't done. Right now, they've got all of these separate committees, and the messaging is kind of vague and incoherent. They could do a select committee on presidential malfeasance that they don't officially call impeachment. And let that run a few months and then see where it goes. But I think that the absolute key to me is that they start getting aggressive and stop looking like people who are avoiding a fight, and they start actually being somewhat coherent on messaging. Because like the Republicans are really good at this. You know, no collusion, no obstruction. No collusion, no obstruction. It's four words. They repeat it over and over and over again, and it becomes reality. The Democrats start talking about this, and you get lost in the complexity of what they're trying to say because they're trying to bring out nuance and this thing and that thing. And, you know, it is a very complicated, nuanced situation. But if you're going to win the messaging game, you have to figure out how to bring it home in a pithy way that lets people focus on individual things. That was one of the problems in the 2016 election as well, by the way, is that the news cycle was constantly, every day there was something new and bad that Donald Trump did, but it would last for, you know, 24, 48 hours a week max, and then they'd be on to something else. So no single one of those things really penetrated and sunk in with the full argument of why this thing is bad, because people will keep moving on to other things. And so they just got a vague notion that, yeah, there's a lot of weird stuff going on with Donald Trump, as opposed to really getting deep on one thing. Whereas the flip side, on the other hand, is like Hillary's email, Hillary's email, Hillary's email, Hillary's email, Clinton Foundation corrupt, Clinton Foundation corrupt, Clinton Foundation corrupt. There were like two or three things that they hammered on over and over and over again. And the Democrats need to find their things that they can really dig into deeply. And like I said, I think like if you're picking, you know, or do them one at a time, actually, there's so many, I'm not necessarily saying you can pick two or three, but do one at a time. And if I was doing one at a time, I would send in a message almost immediately by starting with something that is completely unrelated to the Mueller report. I think the obsession over the Mueller report is hurting the Democrats. There's plenty of bad stuff in there. There's plenty of impeachable stuff on both the collusion side and the obstruction side, frankly. But there's plenty of other things that aren't included in there at all. And they should pick one of those things to go after first. I haven't convinced you, have I?
No. No, you haven't, because what we have here is these loser Democrats just don't know when to give up. What don't we understand about no collusion?
And that's where the no collusion has to be answered. Like I've heard even prominent Democrats saying, okay, yes, the Mueller report showed no collusion. What the hell? No, that's not what it showed. I'm on a page 130 or so now, maybe 140 now. I forget exactly where I am, somewhere in that part. And so far, all I've been reading is that part of things. Now, frankly, a lot of it looks like idiots who don't know what they're doing, messing around with things that were over their heads and stumbling around being incompetent. However, there is plenty there, even in that bit, that was improper. And I think you can make coherent messaging here. And I think, who was it? Chairman Schiff did a fairly good job of this a couple of months ago now, where right after Barr put out his summary, where he did a 2-minute rant on, you know, is this okay? 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 Are you saying that's okay? Are you saying that's okay? And that's the kind of messaging that if the Democrats could be consistent and go after it with vigor, I think they would be much more effective than they are. The problem right now, and maybe, and I guess this is part of the argument, the Democrats are so incompetent at coherent messaging, because this is fundamentally a Democratic versus Republican thing that I've seen for years and years and years. The Republicans really stick together. Like, they want to follow a leader. I mean, the fact that they're all following Donald Trump is part of that tendency.
That's gross.
They have a leader, and then everybody falls in line with that leader. No matter what they originally thought, no matter what they might think privately, they think it's incredibly important to follow that person, to fall in line, to go with that messaging. And that's almost like a core value. Not for all of them, but, you know, for a lot, that's like very important. And where for the Democrats, I think it's very much the opposite. Sort of the whole respect for authority thing is by definition much, much less on the Democratic side.
That's not it.
I'm just saying, like, it's much harder to get the Democrats all in line and coherent on a single message. And so they've just proven themselves over the years to be very, very bad at it. And so maybe you just throw up your hands and say, look, there might be a way to do this. And I think I've described one that would be beneficial to the Democrats in the election, if not for the presidency, then definitely for the Senate and maybe the House. But Democrats just wouldn't succeed in executing it. They would try and fail miserably, and so they'd end up shooting themselves in the foot and hurting themselves anyway. Because I think the worst thing is, like, it's not trying and failing that's a problem. It's trying and doing it in such a miserable, incompetent, stupid way that everybody laughs at you for making a ridiculous attempt. It's the difference between if you're running a race from somebody, being, you know, coming in a very close second where you were extremely competitive and you were doing everything you could, but you just didn't quite make it, versus being the guy that trips over all the hurdles and has to pick themselves up off the ground 5 times before they get there.
So
I'll give you the last word. Why am I still wrong? Why are you still right?
Well, I think you're making an additional assumption here that I hate to say it. And I've had a couple people yell at me for making this statement, so don't yell at me. One of the things that is an assumption that needs to be made whenever you're trying to argue the whole do or not do, whatever thing, is that you're dealing with a public that, 2/3 of Americans can't pass the citizenship test. So when you're looking at how something's going to appear and how it's going to affect the reactions of Americans, you need to take into consideration that they don't know how things work in a lot of cases. There are a lot of expectations that things will run a certain way. And then when they don't, it's like superdelegates.
Yes.
You know, where people are like, those damn superdelegates didn't do their job.
That wasn't their job.
What do you think their job was?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and we see this repeated over and over and over again. And I think this would have the same response as well. You can sit there and say, oh, we just need to make sure we educate people. But most people don't have the time or the inclination. Sounds wrong to say they don't have the time or the inclination to be educated. They don't have the time or the inclination to be focusing on this stuff.
Right. Most people want to stay as far away from the politics as possible. They get the occasional dose from the people saying something on Facebook, but they don't want, this is not an area of interest. They do not want to dive into this. They don't they want to do as little as they can on this, and not from anything bad. It's just they want to focus on their actual life. They want to focus on whatever is going on in their immediate neighborhood that they want to care about. This is the last thing they want to care about.
Exactly. And when you do it like that, when you look at it that way, you have to have a different way of processing. Does that make sense? In order to really understand the impact, you need to take your step back and say, I don't know anything about this, and how would I feel if I saw this? And I think that's what a lot of people aren't doing. So what we're going to see is support increase for Trump as long as there's anything impeachment going on, and he doesn't end up being walked out of the White House in handcuffs, because he will have won. He will have been proven right. He will have been proven innocent. He will be the victim of harassment and so on and so forth, as opposed to actually a criminal. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You haven't convinced me either, but okay. But I understand your argument. This is something that's playing out within the House of Representatives right now, and we'll see where it ends up. I kind of feel like the most likely outcome is that Pelosi holds off the impeachment tide for a while, but not forever. I think we're going to have other kinds of hearings, other kinds of investigations going on throughout most of this year. At some point in the process, before we get to Election Day, I still think we will get there. We will get to an official starting an impeachment committee and going there. But we'll see. It kind of depends on how things go in those other committees and other investigations, and whether or not, like you said, whether it moves anything. I don't know. Anyway, I said I'd let you have the last word, and I was starting to talk, so I'll stop.
It's okay. I know how you are.
Yes, yes. In any case, we'll see what happens. We just have to watch. We will see exactly this debate continue to play out. Okay. Do you have do you one more round of two?
Okay.
Okay. You're up for one more round. No! Alex says no, but we're going to do one more round. Okay. We will be back right after this message.
AlexMZWeb.com. Bang Alex and Dad. Gaming videos and more from Alex. Elementary school by day. YouTube by night. AlexMZWeb.com. AlexMZWeb is AlexMXELA. And .com is period and then COM.
Okay, we are back. Brandy, it is your turn again. What is your next topic?
I think we already talked a little bit about the Mexico tariff thing.
Yeah. If you want to dig in more to that specifically, go ahead. Otherwise, pick something else.
Oh, my God. The lengths this guy will go just to get people to say, good job. It's ridiculous.
Tell me more. What are you talking about?
So the Mexico tariff, last week or 2 weeks ago, he said he was going to start with tariffs on Mexico if they didn't strengthen their border, because somehow making the American people pay more for something punishes Mexico. And Mexico has said, we're going to do more at our southern border. And so everybody's happy. And Trump's like, look, I did good. But then it came out today from one of the Mexican officials that they actually had made the agreement in March.
Yeah, there were actually several parts of the agreement. Some were done in March, some were actually December. But basically, there was nothing really new in this agreement at all. And apparently, the Mexicans were jumping up and down celebrating about how great a victory they got in this deal. And the pattern here, and I've seen a number of different people post about this pattern. So I'll take one of them that I have in front of me, or maybe two, but people have expressed this in various ways. This is from someone, Devil's Tower, on Twitter. who's a staff writer at Daily Kos. He says, the Trump cycle. Number one, do this undefined thing or I will kill this puppy. Number two, I mean it. Two puppies.
Look, I have raisins. Go on.
Number three. Yes. Number three, I really mean it. 10 puppies. And then number four, victory, thanks to my skills as the world's best negotiator. And then number five, let us dance to celebrate how I saved thousands of puppies. Rinse, lather, repeat. The way somebody else put it, and this is it's Jeff Tiedrich on Twitter, ITSJEFFTIEDRICH. And he tweeted, Trump, do what I say or there will be tariffs. Mexico, nothing. Trump, I'm warning you. Mexico, nothing. Trump, this is your last warning. Mexico, nothing. Trump, nothing. Mexico, nothing. Trump, nothing. Mexico, nothing. Trump. Okay, just keep doing what you've been doing. Mexico, nothing. Trump, I win. I win. I'm the best. The best. Everyone says so. And look, this pattern has occurred multiple times now, where basically Donald Trump manufactures a crisis, making things worse out of his own initiative, doing X, Y, or Z that is just bumbling into something, and often on purpose. His intention is to go into something, make an untenable situation, make people like all panic and shuffle around. Then when he gets somebody to give any sort of minor thing, declare victory and go home. You know, whether or not that is something that's actually been agreed to a long time ago, whether or not it's return to the status quo from before Donald Trump made the crisis in the first place, either way, he declares victory. And again, you were talking about the people who, aren't paying all the detailed attention. They start paying attention once there's a crisis. They don't necessarily see the lead up to it, where it was made worse by actions that Trump or his administration were doing. And then they see the resolution and they're like, oh, Trump solved that problem.
Mm-hmm. I was like, how do you know? Because he said he did.
Right. Well, and all of his people say he did. And they're only listening to Fox News and they're repeating that as well.
Oh, my God.
And if you don't know the history, or don't bother looking it up, or don't trust the sources who are trying to tell you the history, then none of that penetrates at all. And so there you go. And so it's one of the problems, another thing I've said many times before, I think Donald Trump in general is a blithering idiot who doesn't know what he's doing. But the one thing he's absolutely brilliant at is manipulating people and manipulating how they think and manipulating public opinion specifically in terms of, he's a con man, right? He knows how to play that game to affect how people think about things at a very peripheral level when they don't have the time, resources, or interest to dive deep into a subject and actually understand it. He doesn't understand anything. None of these people do either. These are the same tricks that work on him, by the way. But, he knows that he can go, and if he says the same thing over and over and over again, there's a whole bunch of people that will believe it no matter how not true it is. And, you can go right back to Inauguration Day and how he had the biggest crowds ever, everything. It's the reason he lies all the time, because it works.
Yeah.
And the whole press and everybody still has not come to grips with a way to deal with that in a way that's effective. I mean, let alone like Fox and people who are complicit in a way. The New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, all of these folks, they still put out headlines all the time that just repeat the lie. And then somewhere deep in the article mention why it might be a lie or might be wrong. And they're hesitant to use the word lie and say, he said something that wasn't true, but and they are saying lie more and more as time goes on, but they're still not regularly dealing with this stuff in a way that actually combats the misinformation. I mean, like the way to actually do this kind of stuff is you don't report it live. You don't report it in real time. You listen to what he says. You do all the in-depth fact checking, and then you report on the facts. You don't report on what he said at all. You report on what you find out was the truth about the situation and ignore the actual statements from the president. But we've had the whole culture of how do you report on a president says that their words are important and you have to listen to them and all of this kind of stuff. So the press keeps getting played over and over and over again with this, because like you said, this is a whole new ball game. The way he operates is different than the way any of these guys have operated before. I mean, some of them have tried, but none of them have come close to succeeding in the way Donald Trump has with this kind of manipulating of the press. And the thing is, though, he will not be the last, because now that it's been shown that this works, and multiple things work here. First of all, appealing to the racists in your base apparently works really well.
Mm-hmm.
Second, this kind of forget the facts, just, you know, spew out your message over and over again. Don't worry about this. Just be insulting to people. Do this, do that. You know, the whole way that Donald Trump operates has been shown to work. So there will be more people after Donald Trump who, on both sides of the political spectrum, by the way, I don't think this is restricted to conservatives, who will use these techniques and use them successfully. So the media and the public has to figure out how to defend for it. Otherwise, we're screwed, because people will use these techniques to win and to gain power for themselves. And at some point, and I think the amount of damage the Donald Trump administration has been able to do has been mitigated by the fact that he's dumb and he doesn't know what he's doing, and he's surrounded himself by other people who are dumb and don't know what they are doing. The next one who succeeds at this is very likely to be smarter and able to be more ruthless and more effective at carrying things out.
Yes, I agree.
So that's exciting.
So we need to change the rules, right? Well, and this is like, I don't remember, a while back, and I'm not going to go too deep into it, but a while back there was this whole thing with local elected saying something on a hot mic, getting caught doing it, and being in a situation where they were able to vote on whether or not they should be punished for having done something inappropriate. And I think what it comes down to is that in that situation, just as in the situation where we look at a president, we have ways to deal with it when somebody does something wrong. What we don't have ways to deal with are when somebody does something that's just so wrong and so unexpected that it just wasn't prepared for. Like, because you expect that the people who want to lead this country have at least some shred of integrity, have at least some level of love for the country, for the Constitution. And we're not seeing that now. So we're in a position that was never forecasted. Like, nobody ever prepared for it because they didn't think it would happen.
Right. One of the keys for how our Constitution was set up on the federal basis is that the assumption that Congress people would defend the institution of the Congress regardless of the politics of the individuals in the presidency. So that you would have, you know, with this theory, congressional Republicans would stand up for the rights of the Senate, even if it was a Republican president who was trying to do something aggressive that took away prerogatives that had been the Senate's before, for instance. And that you would have people who would, you know, in the case of something like corruption, who'd be like, I don't care that this is a person who is advocating policies I agree with. They're corrupt, therefore they have to go. And so a lot of things were not laid out in such a way that Yeah, there were a lot of defenses, and more so than almost any country in the world, power is diffused in the American system, and there are all kinds of veto points and checkpoints, but they still rely fundamentally on each player in that setup playing their part judiciously, and that maybe one of them can go bad, and then the other ones will check them. But it doesn't take into account the possibility of several going bad at the same time. And also, the Donald Trump administration has shown over and over and over again how many things were only codified, were not codified into law, but were only norms that people sort of just all agreed to, oh, this is the way we're going to do it. And we're going to play nicely on this because we assume that you're going to be in power next time. And we want you to play nicely when you're in power. And so we know we're going to alternate between the parties. And so we're not going to do anything that's going to blow up the system. McConnell and company started blowing up the system even before Donald Trump in terms of a number of things, even Reid before that in terms of things related to the filibuster. But Donald Trump, once he's got in, it is clearly like, he doesn't even care about the law unless it's enforceable. So they're like tons and tons of laws on the books that say the federal government should operate in this way, step A, step B, step C, but has no penalty for what happens if that doesn't happen. I mean, one of the examples, I don't think we'll fully get into this, but there's this court case about the census adding a question and blah, blah, blah. And there are a lot of things around the actual, what the question is, what the effects of that question are, but completely aside from all of that stuff, there were specific procedures that were supposed to be followed and deadlines that were supposed to be made for any changes. Those procedures, by all reports, were not followed. The steps that were supposed to happen did not happen in the order they were supposed to happen by the dates they were supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody's, even the court seemed to have sort of glossed over that part and are looking at quote unquote the bigger issues involved. But if there's no penalty for not following the rules, why would you bother? And so that's why the stuff on the subpoena fights is important too. It's like, well, who's going to make me, right? You know, I'm just going to say no. In the past, you know, there's been this sort of notion that you have to do it. And so you just do. And so now we're finding out, well, what actual mechanisms are in place? And are they good enough? And even with this special counsel law, I think it's been absolutely clear all the deficiencies in the special counsel law. I mean, all the hoops you saw Mueller jumping through because he's like, well, I can't say this because it would be that. And I have to report here. And these are the restrictions of what I'm able to do. I can't charge the president. I can't do this. I can't do that. Whereas, you know, the independent counsel law before was much broader and people were scared of it. And that's why they changed it, because it burned both parties. But I think that kind of stuff is important. We have to have, I think one of the things that comes out of this is we need more laws being more specific with more teeth about the behavior of public officials. And that includes the president. But it also includes Congress people, and it also includes the cabinet, and all sorts of people in government need to have more well-defined supervision.
Yes.
With real penalties with teeth if you don't do it. And I'm not going to say there's tons of corruptions in the Congress too. I mean, it's not like they're immune. So, and we need to be addressing that too. And I think that's actually some of the hesitancy in terms of Congress going after things like emoluments and conflict of interest and bribery stuff is that they know their house is not clean either. So it's hard for them to go after that aggressively because it would come up very quickly that a lot of very prominent Congress people in both parties have tons and tons of conflicts of interest that would be problematic as well.
Yeah. So what do you do?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, you need to have someone, and I'm not seeing this happening in 2020, frankly, but you need to have someone come into power with a really strong mandate that includes these things as part of why they won. They need to be accompanied by winning both houses of Congress at the same time. So you have the presidency and both houses of Congress elected on an anti-corruption mandate. And then maybe you could get something done. But I frankly don't see that in 2020. I don't know when or if it'll happen. But until then, you're at best, you have sort of lip service towards this kind of thing. So somehow we went from Mexico to propaganda to corruption.
Yeah, that happens.
I'll call that the topic Mexico tariff propaganda corruption.
Trump soup. We can call it Trump soup.
Trump soup. Okay. Your topic was Trump soup.
Woo-hoo.
Okay. Are you done with Trump soup? Is it time for my last topic?
Yes.
I'm never done with Trump soup. Go.
Okay. So my turn. I wanted to talk about, I just made a blog post on election graphs, and I'm going to talk about it a little bit, but, it was posted on June 8th. The subject line was Biden makes North Carolina blue, mixed changes in Michigan, and what about Texas? I'm not going to talk so much about those, though, as something at the very bottom of that post. You go read that post. There's a lot of interesting stuff in it. But at the very bottom of that post, I've started to play around with the Monte Carlo simulations of the election and based on the poll data. So I'd mentioned a couple weeks ago on the show that I'd added, or maybe it was a week ago. I don't know. Time is timey-wimey, whatever. It's all muddled.
Thingy-wingy.
Yeah, whatever. In any case, a while ago, I'd posted on election graphs and also mentioned on the podcast that I started putting in odds in individual states so that based on looking at an individual state and where the poll average is, and then using the historical accuracy of election graphs over 2008, 2012, and 2016, use that to model a probability of, okay, given this poll average, what are the chance of each person winning? You'll get, for instance, pick a state randomly. If you have a Biden versus Trump battle in this state, Biden has a 60% chance of winning. Trump has a 40% chance of winning, whatever. And so what I've done beyond that, and this is not up on the Election Graphs website yet, aside from the one blog post where I'm talking about this stuff, but it's not up as a feature of the site yet. I'm starting to do simulations where you take those probabilities in every state and you run a million trial elections using those probabilities. You see how it turns out. And then you report on probabilities for the overall election. So I don't have that live on the site yet, but I'm doing those simulations offline now. And one of the things that's come out, a theme I've set on election graphs so far, is that time after time, state after state, as these polls continue to come in, if you look at Democrat versus Trump matchups, if you look at the most polled Democrats versus Trump, which at the moment is Biden, Sanders, O'Rourke, Warren, and Harris, you see that over and over and over again, Biden's doing better than any of them. Not all the time, not in every single state, but more often than not, in more polls than not, Biden does better against Trump than these other Democrats. Now, there are reasons for that, related to name recognition and all of this kind of stuff. But that's what we're seeing so far. But what I've done now is now that I'm doing these simulations of the whole election, I can sort of quantify that in a way that's not just state by state, but talking about the whole country. And so what I have is for each of these five candidates, I have the odds of them winning the national election if it was held today, which again, it's not held today. A lot is going to happen. We've got a huge amount of time between now and the election. But if the election was held today with these various Democrats versus Trump, what are the odds of each one winning? And what comes out of that is you actually have a huge range. And this ties into the electability question, which is what I want to talk about. So let me give you those numbers right now. In order of how well they do against Donald Trump, based on the existing polls right now, which is, again, long time till election. Also, polling is still relatively smart. Polling is still relatively sparse. There are only three states where these averages are based only on polling, and that's for Biden. It's less for the other candidates. And the rest I'm filling in from previous elections to get an idea of where that state lives. Okay, so let's get to those numbers. And this is actually slightly updated from the last blog post as of when we're recording, because there was one new poll that came in after that that I've entered. So Biden has a 91.6% chance of winning against Trump, given these existing numbers. Sanders is at 80.4%. Warren at 63.3%. Harris at 54.7%. And O'Rourke at 49.5%. Now, one interesting thing about O'Rourke, it's under 50%, but it's still better than the Trump odds, because there's also, in that case for O'Rourke, it's 49.5% chance of O'Rourke winning, 48.8% chance of Trump winning, and a 1.7% chance of a tie that would throw it into the House. But ties in the House, even with our current House, would actually probably go to the Republicans, because they vote by state delegation, not by individual Congress people. But okay, enough of that. The point is, there's this huge range. Now, all of these candidates, all five of these candidates that I mentioned, are quote unquote electable. You know, but there's a difference between O'Rourke with essentially a 50-50 shot and Biden, who's at almost 95% at the moment. Now, time to go back to those caveats, though. Right now, Biden and Sanders are way ahead of the others. The obvious reason why is a lot more people know who the hell they are.
Yes.
That's going to start changing over the course of the next few months as we have the debates, the first one starting in just a couple weeks. And as we have more and more exposure of them on the campaign trail, I see between now and when the Iowa caucuses happen at the beginning of February, lots and lots will have happened. So I expect these numbers to change. And I expect that at some point, remember, these numbers aren't how they're doing in the Democratic primary. This is how all of these folks would do against Trump. I expect to see the differences between Democrats lessen as there's more exposure to all of these Democrats. That's my gut. But I think it's absolutely interesting to see right now how big a spread there is in terms of how much better Biden seems to be doing against Trump than these other guys. Guys and girls, or women, guys and women. But I'm
people.
All of these other people between Biden and all of these other people. There's a huge spread. And I find that very interesting. And also that the pattern so far has been so consistent with Biden doing better than all the rest, that it has been striking so far. And I wonder how much of it is, yes, there's the name recognition, but how much of it is due to sort of, the Trump, Obama to Trump voters who went for Trump and will consider going back for somebody like Joe Biden, but not for Warren or Harris or O'Rourke.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? You can broaden it to the electability thing in general, but
I think the only thing, name recognition, fine. Biden and Sanders need to sit down. So does Beto.
Well, Beto has actually fallen quite a bit in the polls. Like most recent polls are now including Buttigieg.
Mayor Pete.
Most polls are now of this type are now including Mayor Pete instead of O'Rourke. Mm-hmm. But there just haven't been enough of them yet for them to overtake O'Rourke in terms of being the best poll to be included in my list here.
So actually, what I like about the polls is that we keep seeing the women start to slip forward.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were polling and they were not doing well in the beginning. And a lot of it was name recognition. You're absolutely correct.
Where we are right now in the Real Clear Politics national average is Biden at 33.5%, Sanders in second at 8.2%, followed by Warren and Harris nearly tied. Warren at 8.2%, Harris at 7.8%. Then Mayor Pete. I'm not even going to try again. Then Mayor Pete at 6.8%. And then if you go past there, it gets sad really fast. O'Rourke at 3.8%, Booker at 2.5%, Klobuchar 1.3%, de Blasio 1.0%. Then it gets crazy with Yang at 0.8%, Castro at 0.8%, Hickenlooper 0.7%, Gabbard 0.7%. So all of these people, at the very least, these people below 1%, what are you doing? What's the point? Why are they there? They should get the hint and get out. Because we're going to have these debates. The two-night debate, 10 people one night, 10 people the next night, chosen randomly. Of those 20 people that are going to be on the stage, there's maybe 5 or 6 that have a shot. Now, I guess the argument is one of these guys that's polling, or women, who's polling at under 1% right now, could make a breakout star appearance on the debate and all of a sudden shoot up. And I guess maybe that could happen. But I think they have to be aggressive at narrowing. I don't have any objection, I guess, to the first couple of debates being like this 20 people thing. But they have to start narrowing it after that fairly quickly. I mean, it would most of these people will probably try to hang on till Iowa. Most of these people shouldn't, you know, and a lot has been said as well about how some of these people would be doing a lot better for the Democrats if they were back home running for Senate or for other state offices than running for president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense, because not a whole lot of people are talking about things like the Senate.
Mm-hmm. And the Senate is critical, right? Look, the Senate is the Senate is going to be really hard for the Democrats in 2020. Just like 2016, they've got a pretty bad map. It's an uphill battle to get anywhere in the Senate. And
it totally is. But, you know, hey, let's actually freaking run for the Senate.
Yeah.
Everybody didn't need to be president.
Yeah. Like the Democrats would have a lot better shot at the Senate if they actually took some of their big names and ran them for the Senate.
Yep.
You know, I guess there's still time for some of these people to drop out of the presidential race and then run for the Senate. But again, getting back to electability for a second before we wrap this up, there's a lot that's been said right now about, the electability argument being totally bogus. And it's just something that's used as a cudgel against the women. And of course, the women are electable and blah, blah, blah. I think that's very true in a lot of how it's been used. But there are also real numbers here. There are real polls against Donald Trump that we can look at. And right now, I want to emphasize this very clearly. It's too early to be looking at these polls for this purpose. But by the time you get to January, and we're starting to actually have voting in February, it will no longer be too late to look at polls like this. And it actually will be a legitimate thing to look at when you're saying, okay, I've got these 3 or 4 candidates that are left and clearly viable. Which one does best against Donald Trump? And I don't think that should be all of how people decide. And if they're all close to each other, then it shouldn't be the way you decide at all. But if your favorite candidate looks like they have a very slim shot against Donald Trump, and somebody else who you don't like all that much, but is still better than Donald Trump, looks like they have a very good shot against Donald Trump, I would go for the one with the better shot.
Well, yeah.
I mean, because that will be a factor, you know? And to put it in very specific terms right now, I like Harris the best, I think.
Yes. Sorry.
Warren has been growing on me lately. Like, Warren has been doing some things that she's more appealing to me than she was 6 months ago, but I think Harris is still my favorite. But, and I don't really like Biden. I'm with you. Biden and Sanders shouldn't have even run. They should step out of the way. They are making this a worse picture by being there right now, I think.
Yep.
But if I get to when Washington State is about to vote, I'm looking at my own numbers on election graphs, and Biden has an 80 or 90% chance of winning, And Harris is at like 64, has a 60% chance of winning or a 50% chance of winning. I'm probably going to go for Biden anyway, not because he's my favorite, but because I want to win.
Yeah, I'm still going to go for Harris.
I think part of it to me would also depend on how the Democratic race was going. Because frankly, by the time it gets to us, it may already be decided, given how big Super Tuesday is. We're right after Super Tuesday, but Super Tuesday is bigger than it's ever been before. The amount of delegates that will be decided on Super Tuesday or earlier is absolutely insane. Now, one interesting part of that, and I know this is a tangent, one of the Super Tuesday states is now California. And that's interesting in two ways. One, because of how huge California is in terms of the delegate haul, but also because California is extremely slow at counting votes. Now, in the case of Republicans versus Democrats in the presidential election, it doesn't really matter because the Democrat just wins easily, and that's clear on election night. But if you remember in 2016, Hillary's margin kept over Donald Trump in the popular vote, kept going up and up and up and up and kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger for weeks. It took like a month before California was finished voting.
Mm-hmm.
For the Democrats in the primary, if it takes them a month to finish voting and determining who gets what delegates coming out of California, that could leave a huge amount of uncertainty in what the hell is going on lasting through an entire month, which will be interesting. My prediction, though, that I made a number of months ago, is that I'm not going to say who's winning coming out of Super Tuesday quite yet. But if we still have four or five viable candidates coming out of Super Tuesday,
mm-hmm.
the rest of the primary season is going to be a nightmare. And you would actually start risking a contested convention. Now, I still think that's very unlikely. This is an if. If out of Super Tuesday, you still have four or five viable candidates, meaning candidates that are close enough to each other that any one of them could fairly reasonably take the lead after a couple more primary battles. If you end up in that case, then the rest of the primary season is going to be insane and problematic. But I think it's actually far more likely that you will come out with somebody after Super Tuesday that is far enough ahead that it would take something really, really, really dramatic to knock them off that lead. Anyway, that stuff's a long way away. I'll make more predictions as we get closer, obviously. Specifically on electability and how that's been wielded against the women in this race, do you want to say anything closing on that? And then we'll wrap up the show.
Being a woman, electability, I mean, one of the quantifiable points in electability is being male. Another one is generally being a white male. Another one is generally being older white male.
One of the things, and I want to be clear here, most of the time when people say electability, they're not referring to, hey, we've looked at polls of this person against Donald Trump and they're doing weaker or stronger or whatever. They're just doing the sort of, does this person seem presidential? Is my gut feel that older white men will vote for this person kind of thing?
Pretty much. And that's pretty much what it comes down to. It's the whole, hey, you know, we need to elect men. We can't possibly elect women because, I mean, they couldn't do the job, right?
Well, and part of that is that sexism and racism are real. I mean, I saw some estimates in 2016 that sexism cost Hillary Clinton 5% off the top in popular vote. Mm-hmm. And if it was anywhere close to that, you know, and that hadn't been there, that would have been a difference, you know?
Yep.
But does that mean that you should have picked a man in 2016 instead because they would do better because there's 5% of people out there who are sexist and you need those 5% to win? I feel like trying to analyze it that way and dig down into that logic is self-defeating. And so, yeah, and again, like, it's premature to make some of these things, but I you can't deny that there's still a cost, but I think it's close enough that you have to, you can't just say right off the top, people aren't electable because of those kinds of factors. Yeah. You got to look at the numbers. You got to see where it's putting, and you know, hell, in the numbers that I just listed, for election graphs, right? I mean, yes, Harris and Warren weren't doing as well as Biden and Sanders, but they were beating O'Rourke.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway. Okay, I think that's a show. Brandy is late to something she has to get to. I've got to do other things here too. Alex is waiting for me to play with him, and I will edit this show and get it out as quick as I can, even though it's a little bit later than I usually like it to. But we'll see. Anyway, we're done with the show. Thank you very much for listening to yet another Curmudgeon's Corner. Goodbye. Wait, I have to go through the spiel. Don't slow me down.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
No, no.
Goodbye.
If you want to follow us, go to facebook.com/curmudgeonscorner. You can follow us on there and comment on the episodes.
Don't follow him.
You can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at Abulsme, A-B-U-L-S-M-E. You can follow Yvonne, our normal co-host, at I-M-B-O, I-M-B-O-U. And Brandy, how can people follow you?
With palm fronds?
Yes, with palm fronds. Yes. Brandy is Scatterbrandy on Twitter. And if you really like the show, of course, Patreon, patreon.com/curmudgeonscorner. We'll get you there. If you can throw us a little tip, you can get prizes of various sorts, mugs, postcards, us mentioning you on the show. At $2 a month or more, you get access to our Curmudgeon's Corner Slack, where we're talking all week long, sharing news articles, all kinds of fun stuff like that. You can
That's
also...
You
can also get on our Slack by just contributing to the show, talking to us all the time, giving us feedback, and we'll invite you to the Slack for that
Don't
kind of stuff, too.
Give feedback. No, wait. Give feedback. Make it more... It's not... Not enough kid-appropriate. It needs to be more kid-appropriate, and they need to be shorter. Give feedback to make the podcasts better.
There you go. And also, please subscribe to the show in your podcast player of choice and leave reviews on iTunes. We appreciate all that. And everybody, have a great week, and we'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye-bye. Let's say goodbye at the same time.
Okay, 3, 2, 1. Goodbye.